I call in the order of the Transportation Sustainability Committee regular meeting, September 9th, 2025, 4 p.m. Do a roll.
We have Member Mayor Mora.
Here.
And Chair Councilmember Solomon.
Here. Moving on to item three, public comment. Ryan, do we have any, or are there any public commenters in the room? Seeing none, any online comment cards?
No online comment cards.
All right. That will close public comment for items on the agenda. Moving to item four, which is approval of the July 8th, 2025 Transportation Sustainability Committee regular meeting action minutes. So moved. Second that.
Okay. Go with Member Mayor Moore.
Aye.
And Chair Councilmember Solomon.
Aye.
Move to that passes. Move to action items. Item 5.1 blue curb request for 4515 Hubbard Street.
Thank you, Chair Solomon. I'm Philip Toss with the Public Works Department, Associate Civil Engineer, and I bring to you a blue curb request that we received for your approval. We received a request from Idowu Koyejo, a resident and business owner at 45 Street. He runs a salon there on the first floor. It's a live work, it's a live work space. So she not only lives there, but she also runs her business out of there. And she was requesting a ADA spot in front of her business entrance. We analyzed the location that she initially wanted right there in front. You can see where it says applicant business entrance. It's right adjacent to a fire hydrant. There's a no parking area, fire lane called out. But we didn't think that that was ideal to have the ADA spot there. So we decided for the benefit of everyone that the ideal place to put it was closer to the pedestrian crossing at the end of the building, about 12 feet away from the crosswalk there. We didn't analyze the public ADA spots in the neighborhood, and we didn't see any. We understand that her particular parking spot in the building is far away from her unit, the one that she was assigned. So this would help her and others accessing businesses and units in this area with ADA placards, as well as the park. We have the park adjacent, so it's not just benefit her, of course, it's benefit the entire city. So the request is that we recommend that the committee approve the blue curb request. And from here, it will go to council for.
So, any more any questions on this item?
Just one question. I'm seeing that we are doing this at the request of this business owner. Is there any back and forth with that business owner? Do they kind of understand the decision-making behind the recommendation? Because one unfortunate outcome might be, she says, this doesn't help this doesn't help her reasoning for why she requested it in the first place. And then the question becomes, who did we end up helping with the new curb color?
Yeah, I've spoken with her about the preferred spot or our recommended spot and why we're going to recommend this spot. And she understood the reasoning.
Okay, great. No further questions.
Has there been, because this is the Emory, right? That's the, right. Has there been any conversation with them? Or once we actually go out and paint the curb, I guess, will they be given a heads up? Is that common practice?
Well, we did do the required noticing at the proposed location. We haven't reached out to the property owner directly, but we certainly, we're going to notice again before we go to council. They're certainly calling and move them in. Okay.
To what's going on.
And then one thing to mention is once the city accepted this, public improvement is now, you know, our city's purview on these curb
sure.
changes yeah. all that. Yeah. So yeah. they have no say in the
yeah. other just curbs. Just a question of letting them know just in case yeah. they got questions about it. Yeah. I think a call would be appreciated, but of course, you know. Okay, so I guess before motion, we should take public comment. Is there any public comment in the room? No. Any online comment cards? No.
No.
I don't know if we do online comment cards anymore. Any further discussion or motion?
I'll move approval for the new blue curb.
I will second that.
Okay. Member Mayor Moore?
Aye.
And Chair Solomon?
Aye.
Motion passed.
Thank you, Philip. Moving to item 5.2, which is RV and truck parking at park frontages with Ryan.
Right. All right. Here to talk for item 5.2, Ryan O'Connell, Senior Civil Engineer in the Public Works Department. We're talking about RV and truck parking in front of park frontages and talking about a proposal to restrict parking for these vehicle types and at these locations. So the legal framework for getting this approval, we have municipal code authority for the transportation committee in section 4-9.22 to designate new traffic signs in the city. It does require after your approval to get city council consent. We've done with curb colors to where they just get approved at transportation committee and that's it, and then we can go and install them. Signs are a little bit different, so we do still need to go to council for that step. Once the signs are up and approved by council, there is now enforcement power for PD to ticket based on these signs and anybody unlawfully disobeying those signs. And then once we get the full approvals from everyone, our maintenance department can handle the sign installation and maintenance of these types of signs citywide. So we are recommending to do this on all city public parks, on the frontages of in front of those parks. So there's quite a few reasons why we are making this proposal to the committee. We are looking at impeded sight lines in front of these park frontages. Depending on which park we're talking about, there are many entrances that go straight to the street, a lot of playgrounds where a kid might be running from the playground into or near the street, and a lot of crosswalks at these frontages of the street to where there might be even some daylighting you know, opportunities as we implement daylighting. So there might just be some red curbs at these same locations. Additional to that is just we're doing some of the SEPTED principles, which is some of the public safety principles for natural surveillance. So keeping clear sight lines throughout as, you know, units from PD are doing patrol, and also for our maintenance crews to see what is out there and that needs to be cleaned up and repaired. The additional factor here is we want adequate and, you know, easy park access for our residents and visitors. So we want to prioritize the convenient short-term access to the park and having people park for short-term visits, not for long-term vehicle storage in front of the park frontages. And then some of these types of vehicles that we're trying to restrict in front of the parks are large vehicles that really restrict the sight lines at the intersections and entrances. And we're trying to eliminate some of these blind spots that happen with these vehicles. And also when they are parking parallel, much of our parking is parallel at these frontages. There's a lot of risk of their turning movements to be able to park in front of the frontage there. So our recommended action today is to install signs similar to this sign. It might look a little bit different. We're going to look at an MUCCD matching sign of this type, but we want to have a consistent marking or sign throughout the city. And that would be no parking of RVs, trucks, and trailers in front of all public park frontages. So we'll be citing those signs with our maintenance department at the appropriate, you know, spacing and distances. So we're not going to get so specific with this motion, but just something to allow us to do this through city council approval. So once TSC approves today, it will go to city council at a later date, and then if that goes it gets approved at city council, we can install these signs by the end of 2025. And I am here available for questions, and so is Officer Steve Hinnegard, who does a lot of our enforcement throughout the city.
Great, thank you. Maybe just one question, two questions. So can you, I'm sorry if you mentioned this, but the park frontages, is that, can you define that a little bit? Like, what, is that just that side of the street? Is that, yeah.
Yeah, it would be only it would be both sides, depends on the park, I guess, what we're talking about. So for example, Doyle Hollis Park, we would probably do both sides of 61st, both sides of 62nd, just because it's such a short crossing distance.
Yeah.
If it's a park that's adjacent to a large four lane arterial or something, we might not do both sides, but I don't think we have, even have that circumstance.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would say we can get more specific on the motion that goes to council and then just add it for both sides of the street. It might be the easiest.
Yeah. And then one other question, maybe question for Fred. So if a vehicle is ticketed and then it doesn't move, what is the process?
Normally what we do is we'll try and contact the owner first before we do any ticketing or putting 72-hour tickets on them. Try to make contact, say, hey, we've got a complaint or we should be looking here. We'll start there, but if we can't make contact, then we'll start giving notices of, hey, 72-hour tow. And then we'll do everything we can prior to ticketing.
Okay.
We have processes where we can try to find telephone numbers. We run the play and we'll do whatever we can, or we start doing what we can. And then once we've done that and we exhaust all that, then we'll start taking the property. And towing is the very last thing that we
do. Okay, thank you. And no more, any questions?
Just one question. There was a special consideration added previously for Marina Park. Is that still being considered, or really should this apply to all parks? And then really, if anybody needs a permit to park their RV for a duration, that's something they should just be able to apply for.
Yeah, what got in the packet, we changed up for this final version, just due to there's already parking restrictions in the marina that we're overlapping. So you already can't park overnight in the marina area. And then we do want to apply the RV restriction in the marina area as well. So the reason the special one was due to some other time restrictions that are already in the marina, and we had to see the overlap. But as we discussed it between Friday and today, we've removed that special consideration.
Got it. Thank you.
Maybe let's take public comment. No public comment in the room. What was public comment? Any other comments? Question?
Yeah, just one comment. I really appreciate staff bringing this. I think I've actually personally experienced all of these issues with RVs at the park. The visibility, blocking access to other people using the park. You know, if I'm having like a birthday party and there's a big RV right nearby, that makes it hard to unload things, hard for guests to park. So I think this is a really good improvement. And I would actually like to see I know you said we could go either way on both sides of the street, but I think we should make it clear that where applicable, it should be both sides of the street, because the idea of, these issues next to the park really does apply in a lot of instances to both sides. So I'll make a motion to approve this the sign program with the added recommendation to for the both sides of the street wherever applicable.
Second that.
Okay. All right. So for the vote, Mayor Moore.
Aye.
And Chair Solomon.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Brian. Excellent. Moving right along to item 6.1, Lyft Bay Wheels information usage and pricing.
And the bar is going to share their screen, I believe.
That's the plan.
No pressure.
Evening or good afternoon.
Right. Yeah. Thanks.
All right. So today I'm presenting on basic information about the Lit Big Wheels program and just providing a little bit of information. There was a memo that I sent out. This has a little bit of overlapping information, but I didn't want to be overly redundant. So I just have some overlapping information for context, and then I provide some numbers that I was able to generate. There we go. Okay, so I'm going to go briefly over the program history, the Emeryville stations, current pricing, ridership, and program. So the first bike share in the Bay Area started in 2013 as a pilot program. In 2017, there was a first agreement between MTC and, at that time, organization called Motivate, and that expansion 2017 of the program added 10 stations to Emeryville, as well as additional stations, a lot more than 10, in Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco. So in 2019, there was a private station added, meaning that it was funded privately. So there are all these stations, the 10 stations were opened, were through that agreement with MTC and Lyft. The station that opened, the property owners at 2100 Powell wanted a station there so they could pay money to have one installed with outside of the program. And the same thing happened in 2024 for Bay Street. So that brought us up to 12 stations. In 2025, there is a program expansion going on with additional stations, and Emeryville was allotted 3 of those. The amount of stations allotted has to do with the size of the city, the size of ridership. There was a complicated formula that I don't know the details of, but it seemed not out of step with the size of our city and programming. So that agreement was actually made in 2023 and not only called for a station expansion, but also the expansion of e-bikes to next generation of e-bike, which is what are being used most now. So once it's installed, we'll have 15 total stations. The system overall will have over 7,000 bicycles and 500 stations. And then the current contract goes through 2027, and there's negotiations going on for a 3-year extension between Lyft and MTC. All right, so this is not the cutest looking map, but it is a screenshot from the Lyft website, where it's a very cool dynamic map. You can scroll in, you can scroll in an angle, and it tells you all the numbers of bikes that are currently available. So this is kind of shows you the distribution. There are rules about, or general rules of thumb, if you will, about how far stations should be from each other, so that if one station is full or doesn't have any bikes, it's not that far to get to the next station. So that would be why, for example, there is no station way out at the end of Emeryville Marina, because it's too far of a ride. You need to slowly expand. Did I skip one? There we go. So the new stations in Emeryville for 2023 are at our newest park, Powell Street and Admiral. So moving out towards the marina, and then at Vallejo Street and 66. So these locations are based on VPAC input, staff review, and location siting requirements, which I just mentioned. So for current pricing, it's about $4 for a single ride if you aren't a member, and then 30 cents additional per minute if you want to use an e-bike, as opposed to what they call classic bikes, which are like what you kind of think of for your standard bike. There's $15 for a day pass, and then $29 for a monthly pass, which gives you longer rides instead of 30 minutes, 45 minute rides, and then $150 for an annual membership. And that has unlimited 45 minute rides and reduce your cost of an e-bike ride as well per minute. In addition to, oh, am I missing that information? Where'd it go? Oh, sorry, I skipped. Oh, I'm sorry, there's an error. Two slides got conflated here. $150 for an annual membership. Well, shoot. Okay, I just missing a slide. There's also a affordable program, which was mentioned in the memo, and that greatly reduced the cost. I believe it's $5 a month, and it also reduces the rides, I think, to 5 cents a minute for e-bikes. So I have some details about our actual participation in that coming up here. So in terms of ridership, you'll see that the numbers are for 2022 to 2023, then 2023 to 2024. These are because of the program contract beginning in November of each year. So we won't have new overall ridership numbers until like a couple months out from now. And then I can come back with those numbers if you'd like at some point. But that's why these kind of seem old. It's the current annual membership information that we have. You can see a pretty big jump from year to year, over 30% increase. Over 3 million rides are anticipated by November of this year. So that's a big increase. And then the past 6 months, we don't have this information here, but the past 6 months of having the new e-bikes out, there's been more ridership on those new e-bikes in 6 months than the full year before for the classic bikes. So it's a lot of ridership growth. People definitely like the e-bikes, and the station expansion plus the new bikes is really making a difference, and also reducing the membership cost to $150 from $169. So, which I explained more in the memo. So here's the ridership by type. So membership, casual, and then bike share for all, which is the discount program I mentioned. So you can see that in terms of membership, Emeryville has pretty high membership, more than San Jose and more than Berkeley, pretty low bike share for all membership as an overall percentage. But that also kind of makes sense considering our demographics as a city and the size of the city. I'm having problems with the going to the next slide thing. It's not doing it. Oh, is that why? Thank you very much for observing. There we go. Okay. So membership growth, a lot of membership growth in 1 year from 23 to 24. So almost 10,000. And it'll be interesting to see what our numbers are for this coming year. The bike share for all memberships have gone up. Emeryville there that we talked about, only 7% of overall 20 memberships for bike share for all. We do have some passes for 1 month memberships coming up, and we're hoping that those will roll over into bike share for all memberships. And we have, I believe, 98 of those to give out. And we're trying to get Lyft to come to some community events, such as the Harvest Festival, to help get that program rolled out more. So we'll see what happens with that. But that's the plan.
Where did those passes come from?
They come from Lyft. They're required to provide it's a temporary 1 month pass for free, I believe. And the idea is that they're supposed to go to community members who would either need a bike share for all membership or who otherwise would probably just not take the initiative because of the upfront cost, even if they don't qualify for the bike share for all. So program costs. There's no program cost to Emeryville. Everything is between MTC and Lyft. What we do pay for is our staff time, I guess, for twice a month monthly meetings just to check in on operations. And it's actually really educational. We talk about all sorts of stuff, not just with bike share, but with biking infrastructure throughout the Bay Area. So those are very helpful meetings. And then, of course, we also, whenever there's permitting, but our permit costs, Lyft pays those. It's not like they have waived fees for that. Then Lyft Bay Wheel system-wide, in 2024, there was 23% increase in revenue for the system and a 1% reduction in operational cost. And the reduction in operational cost is because the new e-bikes that they've rolled out, they have a much higher percentage of the riders, and they take a lot less for operation maintenance the way they're designed. For example, the batteries go twice as far without needing to be recharged. So that really reduces the amount of staff I needed to just keep the bike's maintenance going. Despite that, there's about 8 million in system loss annually for Lyft right now. So that has not been resolved. But we as a city are not experiencing that cost, and riders aren't either, as they reduce the cost of trying to increase the ridership, which is showing is working. That concludes my presentation. And if you have any questions, or if there was something that you were hoping to see today that I did not provide, please let me know.
Any questions?
Thanks, Navar. One question around, so the $8 million in loss, mm-hmm. is that, that's hit coming from Lyft, or mm-hmm. is that being subsidized by? I see. Okay. So it seems like at some point they're hoping to be profitable.
Yeah, they have an exclusivity agreement. So I think, right, you know, this was new when it came out, right? Like I think anticipating cost and anticipating ridership and all of that is a rather difficult thing to do for something that hasn't happened before. So I don't have an idea of if it's been eight million every single year since operation or if it's fluctuated. I don't know, Matt, if you have a sense of that.
No, I'd be dumb on this.
Yeah. But it, you know, it's been consistently a loss to Lyft, but I think they're hoping that, like, yeah, eventually it'll work out. And also, you know, there's, I imagine, some degree of cross-pollination with their other services that they provide. And they do have a membership option that coincides with their rideshare thing. So
I see.
I don't know how it will balance out for them in the end. But I think the main thing to know is that for the public, we are not bearing the burden of that cost.
Yeah, my main concern is, you know, I think we all want them to be successful because
yeah.
Otherwise, you know, this program, which is seeing a lot of growth, might suddenly just get the rug pulled out from under it. So mm-hmm. I was just trying to think, you know, is there anything that I think we're doing what we can, like where we, as a city, we're approving the new stations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if there's other things that we can be doing to help it be a successful and well-utilized program within the bounds of Emeryville. I can't really think of anything, but maybe there's something I'm not thinking of.
You know, I think, for example, getting them, they do have community outreach, so getting them more involved and coming to things like the Harvest Festival and other community events to get the word out about the program is helpful, and I think that's probably one of the best things we can do. I think the expansion that was negotiated in 2023, which is resulting in these new stations, we haven't seen the total fruition of that yet. We have seen the fruition of just the change in bicycles, and that's clearly had a substantial impact on ridership and new membership, right? 3,000 new memberships in 1 year is like huge, right? So I think they're seeing that more investment and adjusting prices can overall increase efficiency and return on investment. So we'll see what happens with that.
And that was my second question was the, I remember when the program relaunched, I think they went from, I remember unlocking the bikes for like $1 and then it became $4, unless you're a member. So it seems like they're really pushing people towards the membership. But one downside of that is maybe you're not really kind of hooking people in with a cheaper price. Maybe this is getting too much into their business, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, I'm sure they thought about that. And I assume mm-hmm. their motivation is to entice more riders. But do we ever, I guess, have those conversations with them about the, you know, that upfront pricing on the non-membership bike, like just unlocking the bike is $4,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I remember that was like the price of like a short ride on a Lyft bike vehicle and not too long ago. So I'm curious if they would be, do they play with promotions or promo codes or discounts to kind of entice people to experience the program, which is quite well run and a pleasure to use.
Mm-hmm. I don't know specifically if they do promo codes and stuff like that very often. They do have these temporary memberships that I mentioned to you. I think that the feedback we get through these twice a month meetings that goes to MTC, they do have Lyft people attend sometimes, and I think that information does filter. So those conversations, I believe, are ongoing. And I'm sure, as you mentioned, they have business analysts doing all sorts of work on this. And there was something else I was going to mention for that. Some feedback that we just got recently, talking with staff was like, I didn't know that memberships were only $150. It should say that when you book a single ride. I would have gotten membership and ridden more often had I known that I could do that instead of pay for each individual ride. And so I suggested them, you should have a pop-up on your app that says that. Like, that kind of feedback I think is very useful. Things that might not be that difficult to implement, but maybe someone just hasn't thought of. So I did share that feedback directly with Lyft when I got it. You know,
that's great. Yeah.
Those kind of conduits of information are always helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there discussion in those meetings about what the future, is there plans for more expansion? I know that when we approved the three additional sites, earlier this year, there was some discussion of if Lyft was going to continue to be a viable company. That seems to be out of the water. Maybe I just haven't been reading about it. But is MDC like planning on more expansions?
I think that's all TBD as part of that negotiation for 3 years, right? Okay. That they would, as part of that, further negotiate what's going to happen with program expansion or not. But I don't have information on that.
And has there been discussion with, obviously, some of the business owners or property owners have installed these new stations on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been discussion with those, with any of the property owners around like signing their employees up for the program? I could think of that as like a nice perk. And if they're in a place that is close to a station that's not close to a bus or go around or something, something that could be a nice, the employees might appreciate it. I'm just curious about this.
Yeah, I don't know specifically for that. I imagine for 2100 PAL that there must've been enough interest, but I don't, I haven't been able to have a conversation with them about that, and that's something that is, I would say, not a high priority for me, but definitely is something that I'm hoping to get around to if they're willing to have a conversation about that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
If no other questions, I'll move to public. You need public comment? Yeah, public comment. Any public commenters? Yes, you got 3 minutes.
I came in late, so apologies if you already covered it, but I was curious. Do we know anything about how the Eagles program is basically, is it working in conjunction at all with transit? And thinking specifically of mobility hub we have at the Amtrak station. I know, for example, one person in this room does use bay wheels coming off the trains for as a last mile solution. Do we have any sort of data or information about that kind of intermodal integration between sort of the bay wheels program transit options?
Yes, I'm wanting to know more about what kind of data you're looking for. So for example, I wouldn't have information on how we'd obtain it other than a survey about how many people boarding Amtrak or not get there using bay wheels. Like, I would love that information, and I'm not sure how we would get that data. The last mile connection thing is always interesting. I mean, I think you could look at the general ridership flow from those stations and extrapolate from that. So that would be something to try and analyze a bit. It would take some work to do that, but we could try and look at that. And that's a really good question. Yeah.
Any other comments in the room? Seeing none. Any online comment cards?
Yeah,
all right. Any other discussion on this side?
None for me.
One thing that could be interesting to add, I think it's useful to hear about this just as another transportation mode in the city, would be sort of interesting to see ridership by station or pickups and drop-offs. I don't know which one would be most appropriate, but that'd be sort of interesting to see.
Absolutely. I was thinking if I did that, I would probably do it at the beginning of the year or something like that, so we could have the information from the ridership that they get annually from November and then compare it to things locally as well.
Sure.
Having their annual information be almost a year out, I kind of wanted to look at things in conjunction.
Yeah.
So maybe that'd be a return visit.
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I don't. Well, I hope it changes a lot positively. But
yes, I hope so too. It sounds like that we had a call, the last call actually, that was with the multiple cities and NTC, they did have people from Lyft there, and they were sounding very optimistic about the numbers. So I don't think that the optimistic about the numbers equals not being in the red, but you always want your program to be going up and having the operation cost goes down. And they were sounding very optimistic about that. Cool. And they were kind of like eagerly awaiting the next round of numbers as well.
So I will eagerly await now.
Yeah.
One thing from last year, we had Nancy Humphreys bring in some data to the BPAC. The most popular station was 40th and Fort Street, right by the Target Chick-fil-A area, right there.
The most used stations are all the ones on 40th east of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the one up by Avaline also is very well used, and that would be our connector to our main transit hub there, 40th and San Pablo also. So that would be consistent with that.
And do we, when we're planning, you know, street paving or new projects, are we, I guess, are we in conversation with Bay Wheels about that? Or I assume we're trying to not think back to different projects, plans, and like, you know, that I've seen them, seen it listed on the plan, but how do we incorporate that?
Yeah, we coordinate with them. We've had to do like slurry seals or paving right where a station is. So we give them a 2 weeks heads up, they move it out, it's temporarily down, we do the paving, they come back in. Then we stripe for them for all the striping around. And then something like the 40th Street project, we're going to be coordinating with Lyft on relocating one of those stations, that one that I just spoke of on 40th and 4th. So yeah, it's definitely it's an opportunity as we're redoing the street. Maybe it's sited somewhere differently. Another example is 47th Street. We did some paving there, and we moved the station to the center of 47th Street by the Escuela by Lincoln. Right. And so that's how we typically do it.
Gotcha. Okay.
And they show them also as decommissioned on the apps and stuff. So it shows that live information. And then I also get weekly updates that shows how many active stations there are. For us, there's not a lot of fluctuation, 12 stations. But you look at the numbers for like San Francisco or Oakland, have a lot more stations. And those numbers change every week because some places being moved, some places there's road work going on. And it's not like a huge fluctuation, but it went up and down a little bit this week. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Navar. Appreciate it. No other comments, I'll close that out. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
That's item 6.1. Moving to item 6.2, I-80 Powell Transit ATIIP project.
Pam Kwong from NTC here. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, members of the Transportation Committee. My name is Pam Kwong. I'm the Assistant Director for the Capital Program at NTC. Again, thank you for the opportunities to present the I-80 Street Power Street Transit Access Improvement Projects. So I'll take slide, please. So this is the agenda for today. I do have a Q&A section. So if you guys want to, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. So I'm going to start out with like an overview of the program. We call the Bay Bridge Forward Program. So I don't know, for some of you may not familiar with MTC's Bay Bridge Forward Program. So we created this program back in 2016 with the goal of to promote HOV and transit usage along the I-80 corridor and also around the approach to the Bay Bridge. And the Bay Bridge Forward Program includes a suite of projects, as listed here. So most of them are actually HOV projects, either modification of existing facility or some brand new facility. Next slide, please. So the I-80 Power Street project was initiated as part of the Bay Bridge Forward Program in 2020. And the goal of this project is to improve transit reliability and travel time. Before we get started on this map, and just want to know that the I-80 corridor, even though it's on the north-south directions, but then the freeway destination is actually east and west. So in my presentation, I'm going to refer to Power Street as a north-south corridor. So as shown in this map, currently buses are taking the path on the blue and make a right turn into the frontage row and take the loop on ramp to I-80 and to the direction of San Francisco. The project proposed to redirect the bus traffic to use the diagonal on ramp, so from the blue path to the right path. Currently, there's no left turn allowed at the westbound intersections on Power Street. So bus will be making a left turn onto the diagonal on-ramp instead of the right turn to the frontage road, because during the peak hours, the frontage road is highly congested. So that would help transit to stay on the schedule. Next, please. The project includes both roadway and transit improvement and also some ped and bike improvement. And you can see on this map, it's a little crowded, but I'm just gonna try my best to explain all these improvements here. So the bus lane will begin at Christie intersections, a little bit off the map to the right, and continues through the interchange. Bus will be making a left turn at the westbound intersections onto the diagonal on-ramp in the westbound directions. So basically all the red hatched area of the bus proposed bus facility. There are currently three lanes on the northbound directions on Power Street towards the bay. And you can see the little map here that includes currently there's a through lane, a shared right, and a right turn lane. For us to build the middle bus lane, we have to modify the existing median island. We locate the sidewalk on the east side of the interchange to behind the bridge columns. The sidewalk is currently, on the top of the map. So the final configurations of the roadway will maintain the two right turn lanes and one through lane and a left lane for bus only. The existing westbound on ramp, because right now it's in an angle, it's a little skewer. So to facilitate that 90 degree turn for buses, we have to realign the on ramp to tee up with the bus movement. At the eastbound off ramp locations where you see the number 4 there, we will be building a bus lane for right turn only. The eastbound bus lane will serve two purposes. One is the cube jump lane to get bus a head start for the right turn, and then also serve as a bus stop. At the end of the intersection, there will be a transit only signal for buses to jump start at the intersections for the right turn. So last but not least, we will also propose to construct a median nose extension, if you can see the number 6 there. Close off the eastbound off-ramp for through movement. The reason behind this is because there is a high volumes of cut-through traffic. People try to save time and get out of the freeway at the eastbound off-ramp and get back onto the on-ramp immediately to bypass congestions on the freeway. Next, please. So here are some pedestrian bike improvement. So the SF Bay Trail run through the interchange along the west side of the Power Street. And you can see that the bright blue dashed line at the bottom is the Bay Trail alignment. It also continues to the other side, cross street on Funnish Road. During the design development phase, we did meet with SF Bay Trail, DPAC, and also Caltrans to come up with some ped and bike improvement ideas, mainly for safety. At the end, we decided to add two curb extensions at the frontage road intersection to shorten the ped and bike crossing distance. So we can see that number 7 there. For the relocated sidewalk behind the bridge columns, number 8 there, instead of a 5-foot sidewalk as existing conditions, we widened it to 10-foot. Note that there's no designated bike path on that side of the street. So the sidewalk will maintain as a sidewalk. It's not a bike path, even though it's wider than the usual sidewalk. We expect that bicycles still using the path on the south side that pertain to Bay Trail to go through the interchange. One of the comments that we received during the design developments was the sharp turn at the end of the Bay Trail near the eastbound off-ramp intersection. Yeah, that one right there. We took the opportunities to take a closer look at the alignment. And adjust it slightly. There are so much utilities at that corner. So we try our best to come up with a more reasonable alignment and to smoothen the transitions. And that's just a current design right now.
If I can add just a little bit. So Pam's team coordinated with city staff and our transportation committee years past about that. And the ramp is a lot wider now too. So that was one of our number one complaints there is how narrow that ramp is. Exactly. Now it's a lot. It's a match in the trail.
Yeah. So we do actually have some additional sign and paper marking to kind of delineate the pedestrian path versus the bicycle path and make it more clear on who owns the right of way. Next slide, please. So this slide shows some example of how Muni does the, I guess, the transit link in San Francisco. This is this facility is for Muni BRT on Monette Avenue. We kind of following a similar arrangement in terms of signage and also pavement marking. The bus lane will be painted red and mark as bus only lane. And it will also include the no, do not enter sign to discourage people like purposely or intentionally enter into the bus lane. So next slide, please. So this is the current proposal right now. This graphic also shows the proposed signing and pavement marking. And just make a note that this bus lane is planned for AC transit, the public transit use only. We're considering expanding that facility to Amtrak because Amtrak Capital Corridor does provide shuttle buses for the transit services and going from Emeryville stations all the way to San Francisco. So with that, the do not enter sign, you can see it actually include both AC Transit and Amtrak. We still have to coordinate with Amtrak on how that works because the buses that, in order for the transit signal to work, buses has to carry a transponder to trigger the signal at the intersection. But that is something that we are still working on at this point. One thing about the transit signal is we'll stay on red, which is the ones on the far left. We'll stay on red until it receives a signal from a bus approaching the intersections, and then it will trigger the signal to turn green. If there a non-transit vehicle accidentally or purposely enter the bus lane, it will not trigger the signal. So it will stay red for a while until the next bus comes and trigger the signal. Next slide, please. The existing off-ramp is currently signed for no turn on red. We added additional no turn on red blank out signs. The main purpose is to increase the visibility for drivers who making the right turn and so that they're aware that this is no turn on red and also for pedestrian safety as well. And these are some examples of curb extensions for pedestrian bike facility that we're building. We will be also marking some of this bike facility green, just kind of designate the space. Next, please. Yeah, this is another example. Next. One thing I want to note on this slide is, you know how we actually were able to close some of this crossing distance on either side of the street, but for us to build that, you know, the wet hatch area, the curb extension, we need to, we have to tighten that turn. So at the end of the day, that turn will not be able to accommodate large trucks turning into Power Street from the southbound frontage road. So we consulted with the city staff and the environment and also the Caltrans STA truck manager because this is an STA route. The feedback that we got is they don't see any concern because these segments of the Power Street already have signed there to prohibit large trucks from entering the Power Street. So that would be following existing conditions. But as a cautionary measure, we did reach out to the property owner at that corner right there. So there's a hotel and a gas station. The purpose is we want to make sure that with the tight turn, we won't affect the business operations, because we don't know how they have the truck coming in and out of the site and how the site circulation works. It turns out that things work out fine. Next, please. And this is the project schedule. As you can see that we completed environmental document back in 2022. We also get both CEQA and NEPA approval in 2023. We're currently in final design. We expect that the final design will be done in 2025 for us to go in construction in 2026. One thing I want to note is currently East Bay MUD has a pipeline replacement project at the eastbound off-ramp at the exact same locations of our improvement. I believe they're already in construction. That project will take place in the next couple of months. The last one we talked to them is the project will be finishing up by the end of the year. But sometimes, like, you know, the weather conditions or unforeseeable conditions. So we decided to delay the advertisement award of the contract until pipeline project is completed. So we will, we're closely coordinating with SPAMOT on the schedule, and we're also working out some traffic staging plan to see if we can actually have two crew going out at the same time, but it's really difficult. Next slide, too, please. So where we are right now, we're in final design, post 95% designed. The project is fully funded for construction. The construction cost estimated at about $4.6 million. That includes capital costs and construction management costs. As of today, we're still pending Caltrans approval on the new bus stop request. This is taking a lot longer than we thought. We have submitted a request to Caltrans over a year ago. This is why the design phase is taking a lot longer than we thought. I think we have a proposed solution. You can see the next step. We plan to break out the design package into phase one and phase two. So basically we are going to build everything in phase one, except for the bus stop. The approach is acceptable to Caltrans, so next step will be working with Caltrans to break out package. So once we got the bus stop approval from Caltrans, then we will continue with the construction of the bus stop as phase two. It will be a standalone project. Next, please. Okay, with that concludes my presentation, and happy to answer any questions that you may
have. Thank you so much, Pam. Any more questions?
Thanks for the presentation. I just wanted to better understand, because I'm thinking about the biking experience traveling westbound, right? Clearly things are better, you know, we have the left turn dedicated for the transit. But I think the biking experience is still really dicey there, and the 10-foot sidewalk is nice, but I guess that's not a like share the path type deal, right?
Yeah.
So I guess what is a bicyclist to do there? And is there anything
on the north side?
Yeah.
On the north side, basically there is no existing path. So even though we have a 10-foot sidewalk, there's no continuous path through that eastbound off-ramp intersection. So there's really no path for them to continue.
So the intention is for bicyclists to cross the street.
Exactly. Following the same Bay Trail alignments to cross the street and continues through the street.
And what does that 10-foot sidewalk look like? I remember, does that run into the freeway columns or is it expanding into the existing street or is
no
it
this is so this is the existing sidewalk right there at the edge of the roadway. See the dash line right there. So basically for us to widen the street, we have to relocate the sidewalk to behind the column. So the column's actually right there.
you can see that footprint.
So the street is widening, and then the sidewalk is effectively going behind
it. Yeah.
Clarify there, the street's not changing, the curb isn't changing, just the path is switching to the back.
Basically, we're taking the room of existing sidewalk and repurpose it for the bus lane so that we can gain a couple of feet from the space of the sidewalk. And we also need to narrow down the medians to make some room as well. So then the external curb on that side of the street actually may change, just like Brian just said.
Oh yeah, this is helpful. So we'll be behind this fence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But are there going to be any improvements to what's the lighting situation under there?
I believe we have to add new lighting for the new path. We did have a lighting analysis that we shared with the city staff a year ago.
And are there going to be any improvements? Right where you're at in the crossing the street now, I'm thinking about the pedestrian improvements. And there's that like little mini island next across from the two slip lanes. That little island is also
We're keeping the existing island and also the crosswalk location, and the crosswalk will line up with the proposed sidewalk. We'll be rebuilding that ADA ramp there.
I see. So the goal is not to really touch anything that's not.
No, yeah. So if we were to touch it, it's actually a really complicated traffic analysis that Caltrans would want us to study the entire intersections beyond the furniture.
I see.
Yeah. So we're keeping basically all the lane configurations at the right turn location, and also the pedestrian crossing. The only location that we're improving is this curb extension here, and also the realignment of the westbound on ramp.
I see.
I don't know if you're aware that the cars are actually coming in a really high speed, because right now the on-ramp is on an angle, and so it's kind of set up for a free ride movement. So with these T intersections, and car actually forced to slow down before they make the turn, because the turning radius is much tighter than existing.
I see, because you don't have to design that turning radius for buses. It can be tighter there, so that's better for pedestrians crossing.
Exactly, yeah. And also, the crossing distance is tighter as well, comparing to existing angle.
And then just another question on that left turn light, that's basically dormant until there's a bus or vehicle with the transponder, which then gets triggered, I guess, from as it's incoming, it gives like a trigger to change that. And then presumably the traffic that's traveling eastbound then, so from number 7 on through the intersection, they would then get a special red light to allow that left turn traffic.
No, actually, you mean for buses or for?
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering the light coordination. Is that all sorted out, like, or do we have to figure that out?
So we've been working with AZ Transit on that. So the way it works is bus carrying the transponder maybe from 2 blocks away from the intersections. They send a signal to the overhead signal. And so that, I believe I'm not a technical person, so don't quote me wrong. They kind of estimated the arrival time. So by the bus, when the bus arrived at that location, the signal would turn green to allow the bus to make the left turn movement.
I see.
And so right now, if you go back to the other slide, we have a sign there for no turn except for AZ Transit and Amtrak only. So if any vehicles entering this lane, they're not going to get a free ride, because all the
except for buses, all the traffic has to either go make a right turn onto the freeway or go through this intersection. There's no signal movement for that left turn.
Got it, unless they're just chasing a bus or something.
Exactly.
Unusual
that
situation.
That would be purposely, yeah. Because we do have sign, do not enter sign, similar to example that I show you from Muni.
I see.
And then we also have another sign here for no left turn.
Yeah, no, that seems well thought out. Oh, I just had one last question on the bus stop, which I guess is the phase two. So yeah. Is the intended passengers for this bus stop? Because that's right as you're getting off the freeway. So you're not quite at whatever your destination is there. Like I'm trying to understand the thinking behind that. Like, because if I was on a bus, maybe I'm trying to get a little bit further and maybe there's another bus stop that better suits me. So I'm trying to figure out who wants to get dropped off there and then who's going to walk there to get picked up.
So
currently with the Transbay buses that come through this section, the stop is at Trader Joe's. So anybody that's at the Hilton Hotel, Watergate condos have to go to Trader Joe's, get out and then make that walk through this whole corridor. So we've actually just recently met with the Watergate Condo Association, and a few of them actually brought up this project and wanted to ask some questions about it. So there was quite a few riders that were like, oh, that's going to be nice. I don't have to walk all the way to Trader Joe's, you know. So that's a few of the riders that would use this.
Wait, so walk me through so these are people coming from where, and then where are they trying to go?
So they came from San Francisco, coming to the East Bay, to Emeryville, getting off on this off-ramp. And then getting off right here and then walking somewhere downtown to the west.
Oh, I see. So this makes it easier for people who want to go west on Powell as opposed to getting dropped at Trader Joe's and then having to trek back.
Yeah, the Trader Joe's stop would probably still exist with this one as well. So they would just wait one more stop.
I see.
Trying to go somewhere else. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the other thing is AC Transit is looking into rerouting the J. So right now, the J is kind of taking on the Christie Railway. It's kind of like going through all these intersections. And there are a lot of complaints about it because it adds travel time. So with this bus stop, it's actually helped AC Transit to allow them to position the buses with the green signal. And they could actually turn three lanes across and make the left turn and continues on Christie. And that's the other thought behind it. So that is the logical location for kind of serve two purposes. We also reach out to the Hilton Hotel and ask, what is your existing your guests, where are they going from, how do they travel to SF? And they say that they have a shuttle or have a bus that carry most of the guests who stay in the hotel to the BART stations. So with this bus stop, it does help the hotel to put passengers across bay.
No, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. So these are the potential market for these bus stops.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Two questions on my end. So the transponder sounds like technical person. Sounds like a cool technology. I assume this is used elsewhere and. I'm thinking of if the risk of a bus gets to the bus stop, transponder's not working, and then do they just sit there until?
I think they could do it remotely.
Okay,
if I read the specs correctly.
That makes a lot of sense.
We do have the specs that I can share with you guys. So AC Transit is the one that should provide us with the technology and the specs that they. I'm assuming that they use it somewhere else.
Okay. Yeah.
I think on this project.
Yeah, we have this. 15 intersection or so in the city for other merry-go-round has these transponders and AC Transit. So you can install two technologies there. So like if one fails, the other one's there as a backup.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah. Great. And we thought about putting a detector loop there. So then if the system does not work, the loop detector could be a backup.
Right.
But at the same time, with the loop detector in place, that will encourage violation because people would try it out and figure it out. But by sitting on the bus lane long enough, that it will turn green. So that's something that we try to avoid.
This one does have a camera, a newer camera system, Caltrans. We might be able to work with our team on that as well. There might be a camera solution that detects bikes or buses only. Okay. Yeah.
And then the, I assume you guys have been talking about this in the context of the Emeryville Loop project. This is, are we thinking of this as just like the bus lane could sort of, they could make a turning movement into this, to this new bus lane? Is that
ideally? Yeah, okay. Yeah. That, you know, they get a queue jump in any of these, and like coming off the off ramp, they get a queue jump to get to the head of, you know, the whole queue headed towards the loop, and then they can get to the loop without anybody in their way. They're in front of the queue. And then coming out of the loop, same way, we could probably have a queue jump popping in them into this lane just in case there's afternoon backup or something over there. So,
yeah. That's good. Okay. And then what, do you have a sense yet of what kinds of lane closures will be required for construction or general disruptions?
I think we will definitely need to close some of this, actually, the RAM, the both RAM, but we will have to do it at night because Caltrans most likely will not allow us to do lane closure during the day. I don't think there is much impact to the business on that side of the intersection just because I don't believe they currently have access to that RAM because the RAM itself, it's actually in an angle. So they're not, like, for them to use the RAM, it's not even feasible. So they have to make a U-turn somewhere. I don't think U-turn is allowed to. So, and it's not going to impact business, but we do have to close the RAM for a period of time. During the nighttime.
That's
good. We actually presented the staging plan to the ILC committee a year ago, and I can share that staging plan.
Great. Any other questions?
None from me.
Okay. Open public comment. Any public comment? Oops, you got 3 minutes.
Okay. A couple questions. So I assume that if this interacts with the Powell redesign project, you guys already discussed that, it's already taken into account. I'm curious about the frequency of the buses that would be using this. I have a few questions. I'm just going to highlight before you respond, let me just say the question. So, like, what's the frequency of buses that would be using this lane? You know, is it going to be constant buses or is it going to be empty a lot of the time? That's one question. And I guess I'm assuming that no private shuttles like tech buses could use this. They don't have the transponder. They'd be able to use it. I'm assuming that's the case. And I was also kind of wondering, has this been considered in the larger context of how residents of Emeryville commute by transit to and from San Francisco? You know, for example, you're talking about residents from Watergate who might be getting on the Emory go-round and going to BART and taking the BART. This, I'm just wondering if this has been sort of considered in that larger framework of how we get back and forth between Emeryville and San Francisco on transit and the other options that are available, or is this just being considered sort of in isolation? And the last thing I want to say is just, cars do go up Powell to the west a lot and then do a U-turn and come back and use that slip space to get onto the other ramp and avoid going right onto Frontage Road as sort of it's like a secret path that a lot of cars do. And so they take that, as you said, very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that they'll be slowing down, but they could be competing with the buses that are making that left turn. Because even cars that are coming, down Powell from the east do that quite a bit because that U-turn is allowed, if I'm not mistaken, further up Powell.
So basically, I mean, bear with me. I don't know if I got all your questions.
Sure.
Okay, so the first one's about like the purpose of these bus lane, right? Or what type of buses are we talking about? I think we just explained that there's no private shuttle buses because it's really hard for us to enforce if it's non-transit. The reason being is, according to the CVC code, and any vehicle with 9 passengers or above, it's considered a bus, private bus. So with that termination, it's really hard for us to monitor like non-public transit to use this lane. It's really hard for CHP to enforce it as well. So that's why we put up the sign for AC Transit or Amtrak. So that is something still subject to discussion. So right now there's 38 buses that going through these locations. I'm just talking about one line. I don't have the latest data for line J, but for line F, there's 38 buses that going through this area throughout the day. So it's not really high. Most of those buses are coming into San Francisco to the Transbay Terminal. And then on the way back, they're riding the J or some other lines back. So we're not talking about a whole lot of buses that every minute or every 5 minutes. So that is for sure. And then you want to take on the other question.
Yeah, so there's been a long-term goal of the city to add some bus stops to this area. There's a Powell Street urban design guide back in like the early 2010s or something like that. And so this was kind of trickling in as a goal for this area to connect with more transit connections right here at the interchange. And this is the first opportunity to kind of really put one in. So, yeah.
As a matter of fact, this project actually initiated by AC Transit and the City of Almaden. And MTC took over because we did have funding from the CBC to continue with the Caltrans process and construction. That's the whole reason why we took over. Yeah.
Brooks, any other?
Did I miss any questions? I'm sorry.
No, that was great. That was great. Thank you.
If no other public comment, move to discussion. Any other discussion on this?
Nothing from my side.
And thank you for the presentation. Someone just asked me about this literally last week, and I have answers. So
I think I answered your questions, right?
You answered them all and more. So thank you. Look forward to seeing this in the ground.
Thank you.
So that's item 6.2. Moving on to item 6.3, which is C-Click Fix.
I'm Sahab Talib, the new operation facilities manager for the City Administration, Public Works. And I'm here to do the presentation for the C-Click Fix, Public Works performance and C-Click Fix tickets. And we had studied the reports between the 24 and 25. And we have some next slide, please. The report summarizes the requests from January 2024 to August 2025. Focus on public works issues, potholes, sidewalks, curb gutters, street sweeping, signage, graffiti, litter, and dumping. The metrics reviewed requests created throughout this period, acknowledgement, time, closure time. And graffiti requests reduced significantly this current quarter, which was a blessing, to be honest, because we lost the contract facilities and we managed to cover the facilities, and it was a blessing to have less requests. It was the same period last year with 134 requests. This quarter was 55 requests. Sidewalk and gutter issues remain steady and consistent. Flooding drainage requests spike seasonally, quarter one and two, during the rain season. Potholes and street sweeping are recurring but less frequent concerns. Next, please. Most requests acknowledgement showed huge improvement. Currently, within 1 to 3 days, the acknowledgement time. Sidewalk, curb, pothole requests average 3.2 to 3.4 days to acknowledge. Graffiti acknowledgement faster, 2.1, 2.6 days. The outlier, some storm drain and sewer issues exceed 100 plus days. However, most requests were addressed at the same time, promptly, but never closed because we get busy with the recurring, we're on site and then another one happens and another, a third one. And it's never closed in the system or took a longer time to close and be closed in the system due to workload and staffing issues. Closure times. Closure time showed huge improvement compared to last year. So graffiti down from 33 days to 7 days currently. Sidewalk curb gutter down from 93 days to 2 days. Flooding and storm drain issues down from 50 days to 8 days. Litter dumping issues down from 36 days to 3 days. Tree issues down from 42 days to 5 days. Weed brush abatement issues down from 23 days to 4 days. City park issues down from 62 days to 4 days. We noticed that the graffiti is the largest number of submitted requests category. It's still in the works, but we're trying to look more into categorizing it, adding more specifics to more questions in the CCLIC-FLEX to specifically ask the complainer about what type of what's the size of the graffiti, what type of, is it offensive, is it so that we prioritize it. If it's offensive, we just give it priority one or two, so we address it faster. Transportation issues, sidewalk, potholes, curbs are consistent across all requests. Flooding and drainage response times in the system are delayed. And this was, we mentioned this earlier, but a little bit more. All hands on deck during the storm that leads to infield response time happens within an hour or at the same day at max. Post-storm regular work orders accumulate, so we get other requests accumulate. So with filling vacancies and work order system adoption, which we're working on now, we hope to improve the recorded CCLIC-FLEX response times. So all in all, the issue is addressed promptly or within very short time, but to address in the system or record in the system takes a long time because of the staffing issues.
What's your current vacancy rate?
Okay, so this has been an ongoing problem. Today, we have 40% staff out, two vacancies, and two are in workman's comp leave due to injuries. So we're functioning most of the days at 50%. As you know, between the sick leaves and vacation time, you know, so we have 50% off. Working on now to fill two vacancies, the maintenance worker, two vacancies. Hopefully, by the end of the year, we'll have more hands-on so we can address more issues. Recommendations, quickly fill the existing vacancies for maintenance workers to allow first, you know, procurement of work order system.
Can you explain a little bit about what a work order system, what does that mean?
That will be, currently we basically paper the pen and paper.
Okay.
So we receive the ticket via CCLIC-FLEX. The supervisor or the crew leader will print it, hand it to the worker. Worker goes to the site, bring it back. Gotcha. The leader will, but we hope to get this system to allow the worker on site to finish and just resolve it without having to go back. Okay. This will be very efficient and hopefully it will reduce the time tremendously.
Okay.
We hope to close flooding, drainage, and sidewalk gutter issues right after infield completion, after we adopt this work order system. Expand graffiti abatement capacity to meet rising demand. Maintain acknowledgement times under 3 days for all categories, and increase preventive maintenance for pothole and pavements. These are the charts that show quarter three this year versus quarter three last year. These are the requests created for all categories. Next, please. And these are the same period days to acknowledge. Clear that there is improvement.
Next, please.
Then days to close. This year versus last year. Next. This quarter versus the first quarter of this year. So also there's, you know, good, these are the requests created. I'm sorry. These are the numbers. That's fine. Days to acknowledge, good improvement there. Then days to close the tickets and the passes. That concludes the presentation. So,
yeah, thanks so much. I appreciate that. And more, I'm sure you have.
Thanks. I really appreciate the presentation. I'm really seeing the reduction in the number of days is really impressive. I feel like that's something to be really proud of. How did we, is there something in particular we did to achieve such a reduction in the number of days to close on so many of those issues?
The HSM, as I mentioned, the issues themselves were closed in a short time. Mm-hmm. But the problem, we were not addressing it. So now we had dedicated one crew leader to make sure the work, as soon as closed, make sure it's closed same day or the day after.
In the system.
Yeah.
You mentioned this work order system, which presumably would make this a more seamless activity. Does C-Click Fix provide any tools to cities that use their services? Like, you know, presumably you would want a system that interoperates with it. I can imagine if I was C-Click Fix, I would say, hey, you can give all your workers this interface on their phone where they just click done, and it's, you know, the dashboard updates, the task is marked complete. Maybe this brings me back to, I have questions in the back of my head about, like, who is C-Click Fix? What is the nature of our relationship with them? How do they remain solvent? Do we pay them money? Are they doing this out of the goodness of their heart? Then I heard the city of Berkeley is moving away from C-Click Fix. Did they have a falling out? Why should we move away from C-Click Fix? Maybe any general comments you can make on C-Click Fix and our future with them?
Yeah, C-Click Fix, very common in the Bay Area, and it's been there for some time. So the public, and that's what we focus on, mm-hmm. the public are very familiar with it. It's very hard to change things from the public interfacing. So what we're working on to get the system that can interface with the C-Click Fix, so they don't notice any change, the public don't notice any change. We're actually going to be working in the back end, and they're going to interface internally with the C-Click Fix. The public will drop the ticket, and the system will transfer it to the new system, and we'll see it resulted, and the system will transfer back a message either to C-Click Fix, so anyone showing this ticket will see the result that's either being worked on or acknowledged or closed. To the question of C-Click Fix, I just discovered today that they actually working on a system that can manage the work order. They have work order. They are developing one that can also handle the facilities. We want to have a system that is can include the facilities and the buildings and facilities and the public.
Internal and public, yeah, okay.
And also the facilities themselves and the public infrastructure. streets and sidewalks, and because we get from both one system that can be centralized be the center for all these components. Ticklick Fix, they are developing a system that can a workflow system that can meet our needs. I'm meeting with them next week, in addition to the tool that we're working with to get the best for the city. Yeah.
Do we pay them money? How does it work? What's our relationship with them?
I don't know the answer to that.
I believe we do want to review with IT or IT department. It touches many different departments, so it doesn't come out of our public works budget. I know that. But it might touch our IT budget.
We can follow up on the answer to that question. Yeah.
Okay, because I'm thinking, you know, because we want to, the idea of a public-facing system that, you know, you have people out there eager to make the city better, and they're telling us things that we really want to know. We want to have a good system in place for that. And I would also hate to invest so much time and effort working with Ticklick Fix when I hear if there might be some better options. Like when I hear that Berkeley is moving, I do think it would be worthwhile to find out why they are moving away from Ticklick Fix. Because I did file a Ticklick Fix report for something in Berkeley, and they had a big disclaimer that said, in the future, please use, we're moving to the Berkeley, some other bespoke system or provider. And I'm curious why they're doing that. You know, maybe there's something not great about Ticklick Fix. And I would hate for us to put so much more time looking to interoperate with Ticklick Fix if there's something better. But I do agree the public knows Ticklick Fix. So there seems to be a benefit there.
I was just going to say, just as a little bit of a background regarding us as a city, because we're so small as a city, our challenge had been in the past that the amount of work to do the work versus tracking the work in the system, the system, you know, updating the system was almost the same as doing the physical work. And that was becoming a hindrance to updating the system, especially the previous version of the work order system that we had. So I moved the team away from that, had them focus on Ticklick Fix with time. So Ticklick Fix performance or reporting could improve. And now we're looking for a work order system that is light and right size for us as a city. And isn't, because most of the time the business models of these software companies are for very big clients because it's lucrative, and very big clients have very complex needs. And by the time you bring it to us, it's simply too complex to use.
I see. So it sounds like Ticklick Fix is working. We should continue to work with them. One other comment you made about the graffiti and how you can, I'm wondering, could we, if somebody's reporting graffiti, can you say for graffiti, a picture is absolutely required? So all these questions about how big is the graffiti? Is it offensive? That could be presumably answered. You can see immediately the picture of the graffiti and hopefully even where it is, if it's on private property or public property. So then we know where to direct, and whether it's code enforcement from the private property owner. Is that a customizable option to require a picture that clearly captures the graffiti?
It's not mandatory. It's not mandatory. We did not make it mandatory to provide a picture.
But so can we?
We can.
Oh, okay.
And this is what we're working on, to add some more or request more details from the public so that we better
see. I see. So you, as the owner of as the city representative of Ticklick Fix, you actually have power to, on the back end, I've only used it, so you actually have the ability to kind of put the fields that must be filled out and what's required.
No, we have to work with Ticklick
Fix. Oh, you work with them. Yeah, okay. With them. I see. Okay. One other question I had, when something is there's probably a lot of issues that have to be referred to police or referred to code enforcement. When an issue like that gets, I've seen a lot of issues just kind of remain open. It'll say this was referred to code enforcement, and then it'll just be open for months, because obviously code enforcement doesn't have a system that interoperates with CClickFix, and neither does the police. Does it make sense? And I presume that we have other code enforcement might have their internal tracking of code enforcement violations, and police obviously have their own tracking of violations. Have we considered, and I'm thinking in terms of keeping items open for such a long period of time, if something is referred to code enforcement, can we say referred to code enforcement, you know, issue not code enforcement violation number, blah, 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 and then we close it off in the system?
I'm not sure about the police department, but I know that code enforcement here has access similar to public works. And when we refer, if we see that it's code enforcement, after investigation, we refer it to code enforcement, and they can refer back. So
within the system.
Within the system.
I see. Okay. No, that's even better. And maybe even the police, because you should probably get pictures of people who say, this car has been parked here forever, right? That's a parking enforcement thing that we would want to send over to police. Is there a way to give police access to CClickFix, and then the EPD officer can say car has been cited or something like that?
I'll double check, but I believe they have access.
Some of my questions, they come through. I did a quick browse survey of some items that have been open for a while, and you can see something has been acknowledged or something is open. Sometimes it's hard to know what the person is getting at because there was no picture and their request is hard to read and digest. And I can imagine if I was a public works employee, I'd say, I don't know what to do with this. I'm just going to leave it here because it's, you know, too hard to get more information. And I was kind of thinking, you know, for stuff like that, but then starts to clutter up the interface. Can we come up with some sort of policy to either, you know, close it if it's been open for too long? Or there was one person, they said they were complaining about a red curve that was too short. It wasn't really clear where it was or what their concern was, but it did seem like they were requesting in the end some type of like a longer red curve. Could we close things like that and say you can file a red curb request from off the city's website, something like that? Maybe don't feel like, can we not feel bad about closing requests? I know sometimes people, it's better than just kind of letting it float in the void. And I'm curious what our thought is on that, closing out things that have been open for months or a year.
It's pretty sensitive to close issues in CClick, in any public interfacing requests. So we're very careful with that. Last year, I believe it was my predecessor decided to just make this date, close anything open before this date, since it's either abated or not valid anymore. But we cannot do this every day. I believe we cannot do this every day. If we can study a policy, timeline policy or nature policy for the requests, if the request is 1 month old or 6 months old, we can close it automatically. But we need to study this first.
And as for additional clarification, I think you can see once we, you know, started operationalizing and focusing on using the system more as opposed to just getting the work done in the field, you saw the difference in the numbers from 1 year compared to the next. Before trying to come up with a policy, I like to understand the volume of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes the volume of the problem isn't worth creating a policy. And that's can be common in Emeryville because we're so small. And the reason I say that is because if you create a policy for something that's not happening frequently enough, the user doesn't remember it. Right. And it lives in a document that may become stale.
I hear you. Scratch the policy thing.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, like for example, the red curve request that was kind of hard to respond to, maybe just link them to the more appropriate resource and then close the item. Like something like that, right?
Possibly. Yeah.
As opposed to just kind of leaving it open, because then it looks, I mean, it says acknowledged, but it's been a few months, and then it kind of raises questions with the person. I'm sure they're not satisfied. I'm sure, you know, nobody's happy in that situation. So just some thinking on what we could do there. Another question I had. Is there like another interface that you get to see, or the it's like city staff can see? I'm wondering, like, is there a dashboard that makes it easy to get those reports? How hard was it to generate those reports that the items were acknowledged within a certain amount of time, closed within a certain amount of time?
There is a feature in the C-Click Fix reports that's in the back end. You click on the reports, you can customize it, and you can compare periods. You can select the categories that you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Some categories are just happens once every 6 months. So you don't want to see this. It's about 25 or 26 categories. So you just get the categories that are more frequent and more sensitive. And of course, Public Works have, we have our own, categories that we're responsible for. Police have their own, code enforcement have their own. So you can custom make your report within the C-Click Fix.
I see. So just generating those graphs that show, time to closure for graffiti, time to closure for dumping, 3.2 days or whatever, generating that as a one-page output, is that something that they make easy?
Yes.
Could we consider, if this committee wanted it, like a quarterly, like one pager of here's like the C-Click Fix performance numbers, just so we can see that, things are getting, I'll actually go to my constituents and say, hey, when you report dumping, did you know that we close it in 3 days? Most people will find that remarkable, amazing. Most cities can't claim that. So is that something that we could we request a some frequency of, here's the one page. It doesn't have to be a full presentation. It would just be just an info, kind of like how public safety or a safety committee, they get the crime stats, like, okay, homicides are down and whatnot. And we would see, okay, dumping is down. It gives us kind of a, like, just knowing even that graffiti is down is a really interesting observation.
Happy to do that. I think we can do quarterly reports. And we have already two repeating categories with environmental program updates, capital improvement program tracking spreadsheet. I think it's kind of in the same spirit. So happy to include that.
Great.
Yeah.
One last question. Yeah. Thanks for indulging me here. I think it's such a great program, and the way we manage it as a city is really, really unique. And you guys are working on Emeryville. You don't know what it's like, what the response times are like in other cities, where sometimes it feels like you're just, crying into the void for whatever the issue is. Could we consider, I would love to see us promoting the program and in a way that, because everybody I tell about C-Click Fix, they say, oh, wow, I had no idea. I lived here for 15 years. I did not know that we could do that. I'm just imagining like a little laminated sheet, like, hey, do you see dumping or a problem that the city should fix? you know, question, here's, go use See Click Fix on the website, maybe a QR code, something super basic, and maybe just put that up in our parks, perhaps, right? Next to the, maybe near the entries of one of the bathrooms, just something that we put around to make people aware that, hey, this is a system that they have access to in the city. Is that something that I guess seems reasonable to staff? And I, you know, maybe I can get this committee to endorse it.
I think we probably need some time to think about that further.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we do have a challenge within our department right now with our vacant management analysts, which is a kind of catch-all category that mm-hmm. would undertake similar types of efforts. And we're, looks like we may have to restart the recruitment that did not yet yield a candidate.
Is that because promoting the program, we would see more people using it, and then we might get overwhelmed with requests, and there'd be more administrative work?
No, so that's likely to happen. And so as a result of the success, then you would be inviting more work. And then the other challenge is that you're likely to start inviting work that isn't actually work. You know, you start getting some types of C-click fix requests that are not feasible to do, or not even necessarily a reasonable request in the first place, some categories. So the more you open it up, the higher the risk of those types of requests coming through. That being said, so that's one consideration. The other consideration is just the setup time to come up with the flyers, to come up with signage, to post them, to do the news flash work, and getting that out. That would be something that would fall to our management analyst, which is currently not a filled position. So both on both sides.
So one question just on what you said about the, you kind of, with any increase in requests, you start to get requests like just kind of general complaints. Like I would imagine like somebody says, here's a C-click fix request. The bike lane is too narrow in this part of town, right? It's somebody's opinion. There's not necessarily a problem. How would we handle a request like that? Besides just, like, say it was where they come in now, how do we avoid just leaving that? And I'm kind of thinking out loud, like just leaving that open indefinitely, polluting our stats, you know, can we say, like, maybe we shouldn't feel bad about having some type of boilerplate response to that. Like, you know, if things don't fall into the categories, right, that are you know, sidewalk issue or whatever, you could say, like, this would require a, you know, city project. Go complain to your mayor, right, or your city council, right? Like, send them somewhere, and because it doesn't belong on C-Click Fix.
I can answer part of that. I get a lot of these type of requests, ones that aren't just go out there and fix it, or it's we got to study it, we got to analyze it, we might need to ask PG&E or my contractor about a street light that's out, why it's out, or a bike lane that's too narrow.
And the streetlight's a good example. That's something that's valid, right?
So some of the ones like more opinion-based ones, it's something that we have in the past as a comment, like one of the boiler comments is to refer them to transportation committee, actually come in as public comment. And then it's warranted. And hey, if it gets agendized, or it might just end there, or maybe there's a little bit of feedback there, or feedback loop is there. So it depends on what it is, but there is that avenue to be able to do that, or public comment at council if it's a certain issue. We typically don't want to refer them straight to you guys, so if you guys don't want that. But we can if you like.
I would say, you know, it varies depending on the council member. But it's important to keep in mind that task of formulating a custom response based on a very niche request could take anywhere from half hour to an hour of a senior civil engineer's or associate civil engineer's time when it's a hard one like that. for when their regular plate of work may be a $30 million project or a $9 million project, or their entire portfolio may be $15 or $20 million or more. We are at higher risk for those more complex ones not to get a simple solution, or and they are at higher risk for polluting our stats, so to speak. That is a reality. And I'm not sure how well positioned, like what you saw, the improvements that you saw were significant. That, I think, is because we made really a concerted effort to focus on the system and operationalize it within our work. But for the engineering side, I'm not sure I can make the same type of improvements with the staff bandwidth that we have when they're complicated and they have complicated answers.
The staff bandwidth concern is that seems like it's, I mean, it's only gotten worse. Is there a, do we ever like augment through contract support? Is that an option? Can we throw an AI agent on behalf of the, say you are a public works employee, here's the prompt, public works employee in the city of Emeryville, you oversee see, click, fix, reply and close out straightforward requests and escalate to your supervisor, Ryan or whomever, things that are slightly more complex and give them a, you know, I'm just trying to think, there's kind of a baby in the bathwater, and I know we're kind of getting into comments, but it's still kind of a prolonged question. If you get flooded with a bunch more requests, right? Some are going to be valid, some are going to be just time-consuming distractions, and there's a baby in bathwater question. What I'm trying to say is that each of these requests, you know, this is somebody who cares about the city. You can go to the parks of Oakland, where nobody's sending in these requests anymore because they've lost all hope that it's being read. So, but these are people, we have people who have not lost hope. They love Emeryville. They want to see it do better. And we should try to receive these messages with that in mind and not just saying, oh, they're adding to my plate. I don't want to manage. I'm already managing a $30 million project. So I want to try to balance that and receive that as it's being sent. And I'm speaking on behalf of somebody who, you know, sends in a lot of these requests, and I can tell you there's a joy that gets sparked when the city responds. Like it's magical. It's very rare. People are not used to it, and it's one of the best ways I think a city can interact with its residents. So that's why I'm really asking us to figure out how to bridge and streamline. And it sounds like we're doing it, right? Like we're interoperating, looking to interoperate with the system. But I just don't want us to end up at a place where we're saying we shouldn't advertise it because we might get, you know, some responses that we don't like or are going to require a complex response. So I just really want to challenge that and push back. And maybe we think about, I do want to be able to advertise this in the future and not be fearful of the, hopefully it's not a deluge of responses, but maybe it's an uptick and I think people will appreciate it.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay. I have a question. And I think we sort of touched on it, but I think one of the other common challenges, in addition to something being just hard to solve, is that it's not city property, and therefore we can't technically do anything. You know, like if a property owner doesn't mow their lawn or whatever, you know, that's maybe not a good example. But sidewalk issues are probably the most common. Graffiti as well, yeah. So am I correct in that the sort of process there would be we receive it pretty quickly? You know, I imagine we say, okay, that's not city property, but you don't want to close it because it's not solved. It's just not something we can immediately solve, not something the city can immediately address. So then does the city then contact the property owner and say, you know, we've notice that your sidewalk is cracked, you need to fix it. And then once it eventually gets fixed, then it gets closed in the system. Is that correct?
We have Philip answer that question because he just did a presentation to VBAC yesterday on the same issue.
The process is somebody puts in a C-click fix for a sidewalk repair. We determine whose responsibility it is. If it's the property owner, then we have our code enforcement officer reach out noticing violation to notify them of the hazard along their property and their responsibility to maintain the sidewalk.
And then is there any communication from the city? Let's say I put in the request. Is there any communication from the city to the person who submitted the request before, like that saying, like, oh, you know, not our property, but we've noticed them, and we'll get back to you or something like that?
I think as a thank you for your request, we are pursuing the issue. And I think at that point, I think it's closed because we are pursuing it through code enforcement. There's nothing else we would do in C-click fix. I don't think we'd wait for the sidewalk to be repaired to close out the C-click fix.
I see.
Because it's a separate.
And timelines associated with that are typically onerous.
Yeah, yeah, no, that makes sense. Maybe I'll take public comment because I'll have discussion. All right, I'll take public comment. Any public comments?
Sure. Yeah, a few things. I fully agree with the magic of C-click fix. It's been my experience. I don't remember how I found out about it. I think from a committee. Like, I definitely did not know about it for the first 2 years. I think probably from you, Matt. Maybe from Ryan, but it is magical when you get a response. I fully agree. I think that was really well put. In San Francisco, we use 311, and so it's a little bit different. I've been involved in it myself quite a bit. For autonomous vehicles in San Francisco in particular, we have a queue for that. And we get a lot of feelings, a lot of general complaints. And so we actually try to give an option for, you know, general observations versus specific issue incident reports and feedback, and try to allow the users to channel things in different directions. So that's just a thought. I don't know how customizable C-click fix is, but 311 in San Francisco, like they're on this, like the same building with us. We work with them to customize this stuff a lot, but also we do warm transfers to police or to parking enforcement for anything that's reported that's in progress. So there's a protocol for, and obviously we're receiving phone calls as well as through an app or through the website. So there's a process called a warm transfer that could go to 911 or DEM, Department of Emergency Management, or to our parking enforcement. That's the way that usually works for us. But and I was wondering if there's a phone number for accessibility reasons, as opposed to just entering through the app, because not everyone, right, necessarily is great at using apps on their phone. Is there like an easy phone number, like a 311 or something like that people can call to report issues? And then finally, Mayor Mora brought this up a bit as well, but I am curious about not just responding to specific incidents, but is this data analyzed from like a trends perspective? Are there hotspots of, you know, certain types of incidents? Like if graffiti is happening over and over in the same part of the city, what's going on there, right? Like sort of trend analysis in addition to responding to specific incidents. I'm wondering if that's something that can happen on this back-end platform or dashboard or anything like that. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
I'll start with that.
Okay. For the phone number, there is no phone number for C-click fix. Yeah, unfortunately, there's no phone number. As it happens that the caller don't have access, so they call the general number here.
Okay.
And then they transfer to us. We recommend that they put in the C-click because it's easier to track and it lives there until it's resolved versus a phone call. We get the message, we deliver it. The work can be completed, but there's no record of it. if it's critical, we can create ourselves, create the ticket because we have the ability and track it. For the background details that can be added, we're working on it and we can consider more in-depth details so that it's like the graffiti, the nature of it, the size, the location, the whether it's offensive or not. So we're still in the progress.
A comment though about trend analysis. My previous job in Oakland and almost any other jurisdiction makes complete sense. Here in Emeryville, it's a square mile.
That's true. It's small.
So, you know, again, these system solutions, when you don't have the volume, end up costing more than they're worth. And the simple answer is our maintenance guys already know the locations right. that are high volume graffiti. They'll typically drive by there to check it to make sure that it doesn't happen. And you may never see it in Seeklet Fix. They may see the location, address it, because they know that's a frequent flyer, so to speak. So, yeah. And that's why, regardless of how our performance has been from last year to this year in using the system, the physical state of the city has basically remained the same. Because at the end of the day, they're focused on getting it done in the field.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah. I just have one other comment. So continuing from my question, I guess. I think that in addition to what Mayor Moore is saying that, you know, when I mention this to people, they're like, I had no idea. Then there are people, next most frequent is, yes, I know about it. I submitted a comment. I submitted a request and I never heard back, which has happened to me. And I think the most common issue is that it's not city property or it's really complicated, which, you know, I should know about, but most lay people wouldn't really know about either. So, I guess I recognizing that it's a lot of, not, I don't want to add more time and take away from doing the actual work, because doing the actual work is what's most important, but thinking about ways that we can have some back and forth, even if it's just to say, you know, yes, we hear you, and you know, this is a thorny issue, and I don't know what the language is. And so, you know, again, if that's an hour out of the day that we like can't spare and is going to delay a bunch of other projects, then you know, maybe I don't push for that. But I have heard from some people who say I just don't use it anymore because the issues that I submitted weren't getting addressed. And maybe this year that would be, they'd have a different experience with it, but just want to mention.
And I ask, was it you? Because I had an interesting experience where I photographed graffiti and, or I saw one of the posts of graffiti that was on private property. And the response that the person received said, the item was closed. I said, this is on private property. And then I sent a screenshot of that to Muhammad. I said, well, don't we have code enforcement that can step in? And he said, yes. And then within the same day, I think you set it up so that if somebody does report graffiti on private property, it can then be referred to code enforcement, which I believe is the current approach. Is that
correct?
So I'm actually curious, though, when you had you mentioned that you had the experience of reporting something on private property, was it graffiti or something or something else?
Sidewalk, the intersection at 65th and Hollis on the northwest side of the street.
Okay, so curb, Cliff Bar area.
Yeah.
Okay.
The curb is like really
beat up or something.
So I submitted it, and I don't think I hope I'm not. Some possible information. I don't believe I've ever received a response, which then I asked Muhammad and he said, it's private property, so you're aware, but
it was a sidewalk or it was on the property?
It was probably the driveways.
It was the, no, it was the curb cut.
The actual ADA ramp?
Yeah.
If it was an ADA ramp, okay.
But I, you know, I heard from someone who said they had an issue with the Amtrak, or the bridge that goes over the train tracks, the Amtrak station. You know, people who have a common one is that I think does actually get addressed, but is like overgrowth from properties that goes over the sidewalk, and then of course gets cut back and then grows back. But like those are some common ones that.
So I think it is getting better, right? That now that we have the code enforcement referral for the private properties stuff. So I would think
that on my way home, I will
keep trying. Yeah. I guess not too much. We don't want to overwhelm the team. But I do love that it's improving. I think that's it. Yeah, there's so much potential. I really want to see it. And maybe I liked one of the comments that Brooks made about the sometimes you just get general complaints. And you know what? Like, even if it just means for, hey, there's a general complaint that is not something that is in the scope that Public Works does, give them the contact page of the new website and say this request, any boilerplate, this can go to the city manager or the contact, there's the contact form for the city council. I get tons of random things. I'll take it, right? Like, you know, someone's late on rent or they stepped in dog poo. I get everything. And, you know, I can use my own discretion what I respond to, but, you know, I would love to alleviate the burden on staff having to worry about closing out items that really is not your guys' job. And I don't want Ryan formulating with or without the help of ChatGPT a 30-minute response, you know, to not hurt someone's feelings, why he's not going to, you know, to take their feedback to heart, right? So I just want to encourage the team to keep using the system. Let's keep improving it, like with the, you know, the pick, how to better sort the graffiti, you know, the make require a picture or ask more questions. Because I think it has a lot of potential, and we are already doing it better than virtually all of our neighbors. But let's, you know, let's keep raising the bar. So I applaud the work you guys are doing, and please keep it up and keep thinking about ways to make it better, because as a user of it, I'm telling you, this is the main interface with people in the city. Like when people come into contact with their city, they are not walking into City Hall. It is because they saw somebody's mattress on the sidewalk, and it's very, very upsetting because that's their morning walk with their dog. And they do the C-click fix, and then to see it get cleaned up later that day or the next day, it's a really great customer service experience. And they see that response to them, like referred to so-and-so, there's the initials of the person. It's just a really cool feeling. So I just want to relate that to you, because I know you can sometimes be, you know, you're in your day jobs and you don't really, you don't experience it from the user point of view. So it's really something special.
It's helpful feedback. We appreciate it.
I can't say any better. So thank you guys. Thank you for the presentation and welcome to the team.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Mindful that we are over time. I'm happy to keep going, and thank you to staff for being here. If that's okay with you guys, we can just churn through these.
And we don't need to do an extension or anything with this meeting either. There's no
cool
time limit.
We can go all night. move to 6.4, community conference chat.
Okay. Well, I'm Violet, and I have a very, very quick chat about compost. We're going to look at a couple different options for compost. And so just for some quick context, Environmental Services gives out free compost pails to residents. We give these out at different city events. Most recently, I was giving them out at the Sea Level Rise Community Day, but residents can also request these through our website. And this program is going so well that we are, in fact, our stock is running low. So we're looking to purchase 900 brand new units, new pails, all of which must be, you know, under the sink or countertop compatible for those of us that live in apartments. Bagless, they must have a lid, a handle, they must be easy to clean. And the ones that we're going to look at are all fairly small, 2 gallons being the maximum capacity. So for our first and most affordable option, we have the tote of organics bin coming in at $5.07 per unit. This is the most affordable, but also the largest with a 2 gallon capacity. However, what is important about this one is there is no ventilation. So that lid does not have holes in it. And this does not come labeled. So we would have to stick a label onto it. And based on our research, labels are difficult to adhere to this specific class. Our next option is what we currently give out, the SureClose kitchen container. This is a little bit more expensive than the toter at $5.95 per unit. It's also a little bit smaller, 1.9 gallons. This does have ventilation and it does come labeled. So what we are giving out right now is hot stamp. That's what you see up on this slide. However, the company wants to reduce their waste. So they're not hot stamping orders under a certain number anymore. So they would be affixing a new label. This is just an example from Bloomington, Minnesota, but ours would look something similar to this. And moving into our more expensive options, we have the OXO Easy Clean Compost Bin, $22.99 per unit, very small, 3/4 gallon. The lid is detachable, which is pretty cool. This does not come with a label and it also does not have ventilation. And then our final option, the Epica Kitchen Compost Pail, $23.95 per unit. It is stainless steel. The label would be required. It is ventilated, which is great. However, this is a compost pail that requires a filter. It comes with 2 filters, which need to be switched out every 6 months. So that is just something to consider. Okay, so that was a very quick run through of the options. Any opinions, preferred options, characteristics that you like?
Thank you, appreciate it. Any questions before we?
Just a few questions. At the beginning, you were listing the requirements. I didn't see label as a requirement. So is the label just nice to have? Like, how should we weigh something with or without a label? The OXO one is a nice bin, but it doesn't have a label. Maybe that's okay.
Yeah, a label, and maybe Matt can provide more detail for this question, but a label, the OXO one, we wouldn't be able to order it like stamped with a label. We would have to stick a separate label on the unit.
All right. I mean, sorry, another way. Do we need a label? Because if we, especially if this is something where someone can clean in a dishwasher, the label's just going to slough off.
No, we don't have to have it as a label, but it is best practice to include labels on this.
Okay.
If it's something that, you know, as a consideration, we don't want to include,
not edit for any reasons. Got it. And you listed some were ventilated versus not ventilated. Is one better than the other? Is it just a preference? How should we think about ventilated versus not ventilated?
Yeah, the way that I think about that is smell. If food is trapped inside of a plastic box and there's no ventilation, when you open it, you might be hit with a really, really bad smell, especially if that food, maybe let's say you're one person and you don't have a lot of food waste and that's sitting there for a while, that's probably going to start to smell bad when you open it, which is just not pleasant, in my opinion.
Well, the ventilated ones... will it not just smell bad
over time?
Over time, like, I mean, yeah. You won't get hit with it, but it'll just smell bad, I guess. Is that not how food waste works?
It could. And that is something we're sort of soliciting feedback from residents right now about what they like and what they don't like. And that's sort of a component of this as well. Your feedback is very important. Yeah, because we don't want people's apartments stinking.
Sure.
Yeah.
What's the budget for this? Because there are some very nice compost bins out there, and there's also, you know, you showed like some of the bare bones ones. So, like, you know, is there a risk that if we have too nice of a compost bin that we're going to
break the budget, or people might just say, oh, wow, that's the new OXO one. Like, I can sell that on Amazon or something, like, or eBay it.
I think that that is definitely a concern. For this project particularly, we have up to $20,000 allotted for it. It comes from a special allocation of funds, though. So whatever we don't use on this is going to be used for other waste outreach programming. There's contamination that goes across the city, talking about potentially educational ads or other items. So that's kind of the like frame of reference, but it's a good point about reselling compost bales.
Well, no, I'm just wondering. Usually the nicer ones are sometimes easier to use, and then you get the behavior, the composting behavior that comes with that. So this is city money. This is not like a grant where somebody said, here's $20,000 to distribute compost bins.
It's actually money from waste management. So that's why it's specially allocated for waste management outreach.
I see. And we pay waste management, so it probably came from us eventually.
They actually pay us as part of the agreement, that franchise agreement that we have.
Oh, that's right. No, it's all the customers, right? Okay.
Yeah. Users pay them. They give us this.
Okay, so maybe the metric here should be a compost bin that we think people will use, and we can worry about reselling later.
$20 a pop.
Yes. Okay.
Any other questions?
No, I do have some discussion for later, though.
Okay. We'll open public comment. Any public notes? Okay. Move to discussion.
So I've had the fancy stainless steel with the carbon filter. I've had two of those, and I don't know whose idea it was to come up with this carbon filter, but it's a total scam. They're just trying to sell you filters. It was after having two of those that just, you know, the filter gets gross, and even when you replace it, and then I realized unventilated is the way to go, the ability to shut the darn thing, and also the ability to put it in a dishwasher is very convenient at times. There's one that's not on here. It's the larger size of the OXO, and I have to say, going from these stainless steel bins with the filter to the larger OXO, it kind of fits like a dinner plate. You could just slide all the food off into it. It's so well designed that I went from just my personal experience, like being an inconsistent composter, to composting all the time because this thing is just so well designed. Very fully drainable. It air dries. The lid comes off. Very sturdy handle. It's easy to carry around. It's a bit more expensive than the smaller one that was in the presentation, but I think we could consider something like that. You know, I don't think we're going to break the bank on it. And if the goal here is to give people something that is going to change their composting behavior, I feel like giving them something that is really easy to use, like through and through, could be worth considering. So I just wanted to throw out that I know you, at the end you said, are there any items we could be considering that are not here? And that it's the 1.75 gallon.
So this one, I'm sure I'm screening.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, you could share it, sure. I'm a big fan of that compost bin. So that's changed my composting behavior. Personally, that kind of like the oval shape, like the oblong shape, is really it's very well designed, and it kind of sits just right, great for the kitchen counter or under the sink. And I don't make any referral money off of OXO.
people love OXO. So thank you. That's helpful.
I have much less passion for compost bins. I put mine in the fridge and it doesn't have a lid, and I've never thought to dishwasher it. I should, that would make more sense.
So I will defer to others on this one, but yeah, I guess to the extent it's something that we want people to use, from the presentation, whatever the the SureClose kitchen container, everything you described, I was like, that makes a lot of sense. Just from a like, it's dishwasher safe, it seems large enough, pretty cheap, but that also probably means it's not particularly usable. So there must be a catch somewhere, because for $6, that'd be surprising.
So one thing I noticed is when you're filling up your compost bin, sometimes you smush things down because you don't really want to go trek out to the compost again, especially if you live in a multifamily building, and then you keep smushing it down. And then finally you say, okay, I need to carry this thing, and it can get heavy. And the OXO handle is very substantial. And I'm worried that behavior like mine, which is like kind of procrastinating on the compost, could maybe deform this bin. That being said, I have not used this bin, so maybe it is fine. But I think definitely the plastic is fine and a good way to go. So I don't have any comments on this bin. Maybe it's fine.
Just to add, if our council member would like, we have some extra ones down at the front desk. So if you'd like to take them home, try them for a couple weeks, we'll provide some feedback. That's
this model, man?
This model, yeah. Oh. That's
what I'm happy with. For staff, too.
Dishwasher for them, too.
Yeah, also some plastic, right, doesn't do well in the dishwasher. OXO is kind of good. Oh, it says dishwasher safe. What was the previous one? Could you go back to the... So this one also seems pretty simple. Is the main difference this one just doesn't, does this like click shut, like it has to, it's hard to pop open, or does it just kind of flop shut?
This one clicks shut. The main difference is that it doesn't have the ventilation holes in the top.
But then the other one also did that, the next one.
This ventilated? And I apologize, I meant to bring this because I have it at the desk. It's ventilated and it clicks shut.
Yeah, so I think this is a bad design, because if I want my compost bin to be open and ventilate, I'll just leave the lid flipped open against the wall. If I want it closed, I just want it closed. The OXO one, you just kind of let it flop closed and it's closed. There's no clicking. And also the clicking then introduces a barrier of effort in terms of unclicking it open. I'd be happy to review. I mean, I can't rule out. Well, now I can rule out this one, but I'd be happy to review the previous one.
How many units are our total cost based on?
900.
And how many have we distributed of the previous batch?
Oh, our last order, I think, was 1,500. It took us several years to distribute that. We have absolutely.
Okay, that's helpful context. Okay.
So we may not even be buy. Would we be trying to buy 900 at a time, or are we just going to buy up to the budget?
We will be buying 900 to 1,000 because we have a couple bigger comps coming online, the Allegheny Gateway, couple outstanding from the Emory, and we just have been seeing a kind of increased request from. What we did previously was give it out to the property managers across the city, and they've been giving out to the residents slowly, but it sounds like folks are running low again, so we're going to do a larger restock to the
others. Okay, well, maybe we can step up.
When do you guys have to decide?
We'd like to do it within the next month. And if you close it for me. But don't anticipate them changing drastically. So if they have more time to review and write feedback.
Do you have this particular one?
We don't have that model. We only have the
ventilated one. Which, yeah, I think that those the ventilation, the forced ventilation is a bad idea. So I would advise against that. So that's my two cents. You guys are not bound to follow it, but you know, if finances allow, I recommend the actually I would recommend the larger OXO if that's an option.
Great, thank you so much.
And you can buy some. It comes in gray and white. So, you know, well, people, they want, if it's on your counter, you want it, you know, people want a pretty kitchen sometimes, right? So maybe buy some of each. And
it's fine. But if you lose your day job, you can go work for OXO. Be good with us.
Thank you, Val. I appreciate it. If we have everything you need, then we can move on to... all right, thank you. 6.4 is done, so move on to 6.5, environmental programs updates.
Ooh, that's me.
All right.
Can see if any text and everything. All right, just a few quick updates from the environmental program side. We have a lot happened and a lot that is happening. So a quick reminder that AVA has e-bike rebates that are ongoing. There's monthly drawings. Emeryville has a really high participation rate, one of the highest rates in the Bay, actually, but we'll keep that going. So please tell everyone you know, and we'll be sending out another news flash about that. And that is monthly through September 2026. CoverCycle recently announced that they're taking on enforcement of the statewide polystyrene ban, which is great. It was already banned in Emeryville for foodware, but it is now statewide and they will be enforcing it. They've created a web portal. So if you do go to restaurants and see polystyrene foodware, they've got a way to announce that, I guess. Two bills that have affected us locally, IAB 2902 and 2346. CalRecycle has allowed us to use wood that we've chipped within municipal limits as counting towards our annual organic material procurement targets. There's a requirement set by SB 1383, which is great. And then also the targets themselves have adjusted for the characterization of our local waste stream, which is basically to say we're already composting at a high level, so we're not required to divert so much. We also will be doing some installations of trash capture devices across the city later this month, so stay tuned for updates on that. The tree planting project is kicking off this week, and we'll be having a groundbreaking ceremony in the next 2 months, so also you will be getting an invite there. I'm also pleased to announce that the SB1 funding that was mentioned last meeting was recommended for funding to the OPC. We'll be hearing a final declaration about that on September 20th, but staff at the OPC level is recommending that to the board for funding. So I was reduced a little bit, but that could potentially be funding for us to start our sea level rise adaptation vulnerability assessment. Our SAP production on a regional level. And last and very much not least, coastal cleanup is coming September 20th, 9 a.m. to noon, fire station. Violet has been organizing and doing a lot of work. Thanks to her, there will be a prize this year, a secret treasure hunt prize that will be hidden. So get there early. It's going to be fun. Food, coffee, community, and this year, thanks to Violet, updated flora and fauna facts of the Emeryville Crescent. So come to learn some cool things. And that's all I've got for you now.
Thank you, Matt. Any questions?
No questions. I like the flyer on the coastal cleanup. That's nice.
Any public comment? Well, thank you, as always, Matt. And appreciate the puns and all the news flashes we've gotten on that. Appreciate the excitement.
Oh, one question. Will we get, is that going to be on the, are we plugging that on the new website at all?
Yes, there should have been an announcement that went out as a newsflash, but there's another one scheduled for next Monday as well. That'll be going out, and that'll be heard on Instagram and Twitter.
We have that still. There is currently an Instagram post up, and a newsflash went out, and then Instagram and newsflash again next.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not Twitter.
So when I go to the city website, I click newsflash, and I see Harvest Festival volunteers, summer movie night, Owl Street redesign, but I don't see.
Nora Davis cleanup is I think it was posted a while ago, is under events.
Yeah, so we did kind of try to avoid spamming people. We usually send one out as a save the day and one out that gets a little bit closer. But
I feel like we need it's like the next five upcoming city events, like on the city website. Maybe this is more just feedback for the website. It's like what's coming up. It doesn't have to be like a full fledged calendar, but like here's the next. Yeah, this month's coming events.
Currently, we've got three. And I think it's, do keep in mind when you're on a cell phone.
People go to the websites on their cell phone these days, right?
Right. So if you made it, the challenge is that you've got the latest news underneath events. And so if you were to make the number of tiles even longer before you get to latest news, it may be difficult to reach it.
Wait, where are you? Oh, upcoming events.
Exactly. That's clear. Which is before the news.
Ah, I see. So we have Commission on Aging meeting. Interesting. I actually think upcoming events, maybe I'll talk to LaTanya about this. I feel like if you just put the committee meetings, that's kind of different from like events, like cleanups, Harvest Festival. I feel like we should find a way to prioritize those, so then we don't, you don't kind of just drown things in committee meetings.
I think they have a mix right now.
Yeah,
it's all of the above right now is the list.
Okay. So
both committee meetings and events.
Yeah, that's something we can. I think we're working on tweaking the website and how things work.
But anything else on?
Not for me.
Programs? Okay. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. Close 6.5 and go to 6.6.
All right. So we have added a hyperlink here, so you can go to this to look at our spreadsheet now. We do have an item going to council, special study session, that will go a little bit more in depth than today on all of these projects. So if you want to pause on a certain project today, we can go a little bit more in depth, and then otherwise I'll kind of breeze through on them.
Can I ask a question about this? So will the study session be just going through this list as it exists, or it's for the new list?
The study session will be a combination of everything we accomplished from the CIP 2328,
mm-hmm.
and then going through on the recently approved budget, 25-27 mm-hmm. budget, and showing you the deltas in funding from the originally planned program funding from the 23-28 CIP.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
All righty. So from community facilities, the one project with an update is our corporation yard improvements, maintenance yard relocation, the FMW site remediation, and construction is ongoing. Actually, Mom, do you have a timeline, a rough timeline about the FMW site on Horton Street?
I don't have that.
Okay.
Information. And Mike, do you have?
Generally going to pave out the site and hardscape it here coming up October time period, and then start building a temporary building on site after that.
So the remediation is nearly complete?
Yeah, nearly complete. Yep.
Great. Perfect.
Did you zoom in?
Yeah, sorry. I'm even struggling to read it. Okay, so again, on the climate action plan, that is the CIP project that helps fund some of the efforts in the coastal cleanup. So again, September 20th, please come out. We have been working on public facilities and our public sewer laterals. So there's been a project that's the construction has already started. It's going to be taking place throughout fiscal year 25-26. And we've, knocked out at least one of these laterals already and working on others at other public facilities like our fire department, police station, city hall, things like that. North Hall's underground district, we are working with PG&E on finalizing an estimate for this project. It does look like a little bit over $1 million will be available for use on this project here in the near future. We're still trying to figure out best way to fund this project. It will be probably coming to a future meeting in a more in-depth discussion. Our sustainable streetscapes continues with the work on Hollis Street corridor. So a lot of the concrete improvements have been put in. The contractor has been working on the Powell Hollis slip lane removal area and the plaza construction. The concrete seat walls just got poured yesterday, if you've been out there. We have also removed the large wind spire sculpture that was there at the Powell Hollis intersection. We're removing it for a new piece of public art that's going to be placed later this fall. Other work that's ongoing is underground conduit work for the traffic signals at Park and at Hollis. So our contractor's working on some of those items this week. We're hoping to pour a foundation for a new large mast arm and signal relocation over at Powell Hollis. And that's the big kind of critical piece that corner. So we're looking at in October for a lot of the paving for Hollis Street, and that will trickle into Doyle Street, which is also included in the project. And looking for November-ish completion for Hollis Street. So that's what it's looking like right now. Our Powell Street redesign project is still in our planning phase through the ATP study CIP project. We're going through community input. We just had a meeting with the Watergate HOA. We're trying to inform our 10% design, which will again make its way to City Council for other approvals and feedback.
And as an addition to that, we should be bringing to you all a 10% design once we're done with the community meetings at this committee for your review of the plan layout.
Our traffic signals and streetlights project. Actually, I think I missed on updating this note, but we have at our BPAC last night, they approved a bike confirmation light to be installed at 59th and Hollis. So this is a little sign that will be for bikes as they get to an intersection, and will say, hey, illuminated, when this is illuminated, you're being detected. So it gives like confirmation that you're actually being seen by the camera. That's something that we'll be knocking out with that CIP project. The 40th Street project is still in environmental phase and design phase. So we're working through some items with Caltrans right now, and we'll be doing some tribal outreach meetings in the coming months. We're still hoping to finish this process by the end of the year and hope to get ready to approve the project and bid the project out early next year. And we have completed a street tree study through this project, the FM13 CIP project, which has turned into our urban tree planting program project. That bid has been awarded. We are going to have a pre-con this month with the contractor and hoping to start planting trees in October, November of this year. Going back up here. Our parks project, we also awarded a contract with PlaceWorks for an amount of $650,000 at the May 6th City Council. We added marina funding into the project to be made available, and we're doing a September site walk with our planning team to start formulating ideas for these parks throughout the city.
Just happened before this meeting.
Oh, and then, there you go. And I think that's about it for updates. So if you have any other questions or you want to focus on a project, let us know.
Any questions for you?
On 40th Street, we're still waiting on Caltrans approval. Is that
correct?
Is there
there a specific, I guess, do we have like a path forward? Is there, have we reached like a kind of an impasse on anything with Caltrans? I guess what would help things to move along?
We're going through their NEPA process on the project. So due to receiving federal funds for the project, we had to recertify our environmental clearances on the project. So we have to recertify the CEQA end. The CEQA end is more city driven with submittals. The NEPA side is driven by Caltrans and their processes. They actually lead the effort. So we are having focused coordination meetings with them to make sure that we're getting quick feedback. They're set scheduled meetings in a timely fashion. So right now, I wouldn't say there's much we can do on our end to accelerate them or anything like that. We're just...
Well, actually, what I was getting at is if we don't feel like we're receiving a response from them, and we need somebody higher up in Caltrans, the city's lobbyist has offered to support that communication. So just reach out to, just coordinate through LaTanya. I connected her to the, I updated him on the project, and he's eager to help us keep making progress.
Yep.
Just one other question: the sustainable streetscapes and the work that's going on Hollis. Is that the same work that's going to help us with get those speed bumps on those the Greenway 66th and 67th?
Same project.
Okay.
Same timeline.
Yeah. As our contractor's paving on Doyle Street, that's going to be kind of just a easy extension of the Doyle Street paving, and they'll deploy out to those other intersections.
And then related to that, as you guys know, I reached out to the mayor of Berkeley to see if we could also get speed bumps on Bolger Street, and it seems like you've already talked to their staff. Everybody kind of understands the need. Has there been any, since I sent the letter, has there been any more conversation, I guess, with their staff? Or do they have everything that they need to proceed? Are they waiting for a green light from the mayor? I guess, have you heard anything else from them?
Not at this point. In the initial discussions with staff, they did mention a 2-month turnaround time. I think as we get closer to our actual implementation, it will probably be a good time to check back in with them and see where they're at.
Okay.
Yeah, but we're not too far away from implementation.
Yeah, it would be great to see like all three of those streets just safer at the same time.
All four?
Agreed.
Four, 66, 67.
Yeah, 65th. 65th is going to get redone with the speed up.
Okay. Well. Yeah, that's right. And we're also going to trim the trees so people can see.
Any other questions?
That's all I had.
All of them that were comment quickly. Any
public okay, questions? Sorry, just one more question. Sorry about that. The video detection on the bikes, is that something that are we going to test out and then we might roll out more citywide?
Yeah, we already have it citywide pretty much. I think it's, what's our count that I just did? We have 35 signals, I don't know, 20-something signals have video detection to detect bikes. This, the thing I mentioned is not a video detection for bikes. It's a confirmation light using the existing technology there. It's just going to be an additional, like, notification light that said, hey, you're detected, and
is great, right? Yeah. Like, bikes are always wondering until it turns green, and they always, to this day, I always say, did it detect me, or did it just happen to turn green, right? So the idea of a feedback is super cool. That's why I'm just wondering, is it something that feedback is, could we roll, would that be rolled out?
Yeah, more broadly? Yeah. So we're trying it out there. Okay. It does have a cost. So we do want to see how best to implement it, if there's improvements on it. So we're taking it out of the box from the manufacturer solution, going to try that out, get some feedback from the BPAC on that location, and then it could shape into a new CIP project or something like that to do a more citywide effort. Okay. But right now, with our existing budgets, we couldn't do citywide.
Understood. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad we're exploring that.
Public comment? Yeah, just couple things. So Powell Street redesign. I did look at the presentation that you gave to the Watergate community, and it does mention there, like, you know, the proposals, there's significant transit components, obviously, of the design, of the chosen design from a couple of meetings ago. And part of that is an increase in frequency of the service, of every go-round service on Powell, on the Shell Powell route, and then also some changes to the stops as well. And as it does mention in the presentation, this is like under the purview of ETMA, and you're just talking about the timeline for sort of getting review and feedback. Are you guys planning to come to ETMA for feedback on those particular elements of the plan? If so, when do you need it from us by? Is it September or October? We have a meeting next week, but it's a chock full. Like, when do you guys need that? And then the second piece just could be, I think it would be great if we could learn, if the ETMA board could know more about the 40th Street multimodal project and how that impacts merry-go-round service, because we're going through this whole strategic, you know, plan, we're rethinking the service, all sorts of stuff. It'd be really helpful to have that in the frame of those discussions. It's not as urgent, but anyway, those are my...
Yeah, and so timely question and comments. Yeah, we are planning to go to the October ETMA board meeting.
Okay.
There's a conversation with Daniel. It's not certain which items all get there, but okay. we're looking to be there at that meeting with items that ETMA has been asking about. So. Yeah.
Okay. And that's in time for your.
Yeah, certainly for Powell Street, it's an unfunded construction project, still going through the planning phases, so there's time for that. Okay.
And sorry, usually the type of concerns that you guys would have around the level of design occurs at a later stage in design, and usually at that stage in design, we're having direct conversations with you.
Okay.
But Julie noted.
And by you mean the board?
ETMA, we would be talking to you if we were, you know, as we, you know, work out the design, then we'd say, hey, you know, just like we've been doing with different constituencies, as we get more specific, we have dimensions, we have a length, so on and so forth, and then we bring that to you for a discussion, the ETMA.
Oh, okay, I see. But that's not part of like the project pipeline for like say EPAC or this committee. This would be much later in the project's life cycle. Is that what you're saying?
It's usually the type of information. There's a level where we can have a preliminary discussion, and then there's a level where we need more detailed feedback, and that normally happens later on in the design, and would happen with us directly outreaching to Emory Go Round.
Okay, that's great. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it. The public comment?
Yes, hi, I'm from Gabe Berlin, also a resident of the town. I just wanted to comment on the urban trade planning project. It seems pretty exciting. I'm wondering if native trees have been considered. If you're planting this fall, I'm assuming it's too late for sourcing those trees, but I just want to give the general comment that native trees support insects and therefore everything like food chain and birds. And so I hope that we will consider native tree species in the future and our organization and specific species.
Comment, Matt, do you have any adds or quick things on that?
Yeah, quick add is, yes, it was one of the considerations. A lot of them are out of the marina, so wind resistance and salinity resistance are another consideration. But happy to chat with you after this about the species issue.
Okay, cool. Yes, the ocean's always been here, so yeah. We have native species that are salinity resistant. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate being here. Excellent. I thought I had a comment, but I'll mention it later because I can't remember what it was. No more. Any other comments on CIP items?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate it. And we'll discuss in more depth next week. Moving on to future agenda items. Looks like we've got a packed October. and stuff going in the future. Anything else?
There were two that may have dropped off.
I was going to mention that as well. Yeah, so they're in our minutes. We forgot to add them right here to the agenda, but once the Raptor program and the Greenway signage item. So we're going to add that into the future for sure.
Okay, yeah, great. Yeah, those were my two.
I don't think I have anything else that's big enough to get on the list. So, but this will keep us busy for a little bit, I think. So no other future agenda items, can move to announcements and member comments. Announcements and member comments?
I just want to check. I don't need to add the trash can thing as a future agenda. We can, the Doyle Hollis solar trash can.
Replace. We'll figure it out.
Okay.
And we'll, unless you want to add it, of course, as an agenda.
We've got a packed enough agenda.
Yeah. I defer to you.
I don't think I have any announcements. So with that, it is 6:51, adjourn this meeting.